theguardian.co.uk.
Have you always wanted to write a novel, a history, a short story, your epitaph? Want to know how successful authors do it? It's all in a new Guardian book. I'll tell you more at the end of this podcast.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Moby Dick, or The Whale, by Herman Melville. Chapter 1. Loomings.
Call me Ishmael. Some years ago, never mind how long precisely, having little or no money in my purse, and nothing particular to interest me on shore, I thought I would sail about a little and see the watery part of the world. It's a way I have of driving off the spleen and regulating the circulation. Whenever I find myself growing grim about the mouth, whenever it's a damp, drizzly November in my soul, whenever I find myself involuntarily pausing before coffin warehouses and bringing up the rear of every funeral I meet, and especially whenever my hypos get such an upper hand of me that it requires a strong moral principle to prevent me from deliberately stepping into the street and methodically knocking people's hats off, then I account it high time to get to sea as soon as I can.
New ventures are breaking out all over. After a continuous reading of the whole of Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby wowed London West End theatregoers this summer, The Autumn brings a website devoted to reading aloud the whole of Herman Melville's Moby Dick, a whale of a tale if ever there was one. It comes from the University of Plymouth and involves some top-level celebrity enthusiasts. You've just heard Tilda Swinton. Now, brace yourself for our next reader.
When Stubb had departed, Ahab stood for a while, leaning over the bulwarks, and then, as had been usual with him of late, calling a sailor of the watch, he sent him below for his ivory stool and also his pipe. Lighting the pipe at the binnacle lamp and planting the stool on the weather side of the deck, he sat and smoked. In old Norse times, the thrones of the sea-loving Danish kings were fabricated, saith tradition, of the tusks of the narwhal. How could one look at Ahab then, seated on that tripod of bones, without bethinking him of the royalty it symbolised? For a Khan of the plank, and a king of the sea, and a great lord of leviathans was Ahab.
Yes, not only does President Barack Obama declare himself a fan, but so does our own Premier David Cameron. 'Twas he. The project is the brainchild of Philip Hoare, who won the Samuel Johnson Prize for Nonfiction in 2009 for his book about whales, Leviathan. Richard Lee asked him which came first, his love of cetaceans or Moby Dick.
I guess it was both, actually. I mean, I remember as a kid watching on our crackly old television set, which had a veneered wooden cabinet, John Huston's movie, a 1956 movie of Moby Dick. And I was already fascinated by whales. But actually, I remember being really disappointed that there weren't more whales in the movie. I didn't realise that, in fact, they had this sort of fantastic radio-controlled whale that they'd made, and it had actually got loose in the Irish Sea, and they had to send the RAF after it to intercept it as a hazard to shipping. So I didn't know any of that, but I wanted to get into the world of Moby Dick because of the whale. Mm. I wasn't on Ahab's side. Mm. You know, I was always an Indian. I wasn't a cowboy.
Because so, you were brought up in Southampton, weren't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, by the sea. But, you know, I never learnt to swim until I was 25. So I can't claim this kind of affinity with the water.
It was the romance of it, the rumour of their existence in the sea that captured you.
Absolutely. And that great sort of Freudian dream we all have of the deep ocean filled with these extraordinary monsters, you know. that live in your imagination. And that's something that's still, I mean, I was swimming in the sea yesterday and I still get scared about what's down there.
So if you first encountered the book via the black and white film, when was your first encounter with the artifact itself?
Well, it took me a hell of a long time to get into it because I was incredibly put off by the book, I suppose. I mean, I studied Melville's short fiction when I was at college, and in fact, you know, read Billy Budd and Bartleby the Scrivener, the Melville's short fiction, which is fantastic and incredibly evocative. And it was only once I started to realise the kind of sense of humour of the book and its subversion and the kind of madness of the man and of the creation. Once I realised that it wasn't this kind of dour, Victorian tome, you know, overladen with kind of sententious meaning, that in fact it's incredibly lively, sparky. You know, it really is a postmodern work. And so, I mean, but even then it took me three goes before I could actually make it to the end.
Are you at one in that case with the 1851 London Literary Gazette reviewer who complained of the set logical learning that he uses as stuffing to fill out his skeleton story? Bad stuffing it makes, he continues, serving only to try the patience of his readers and to tempt them to wish both him and his whales at the bottom of an unfathomable sea. So is Moby Dick a book to skim rather than to read in full?
I always say you can read like you would read, you know, verses from the Quran or, you know, bits from the Bible, you know, because they're self-contained, those chapters. They are worlds within themselves because of the way Melville's mind worked, the way he did his research, which was incredibly plagiaristic. I mean, he would steal books from the New York Public Library. He never took them back. And he literally copy out sections from books like Thomas Beale's The Natural History of the Sperm Whale, which had been published in 1835. And he just copied them wholesale into his book. So you have, and this is why I think, you know, what we're doing at the moment with the big read works really well, because there's this kind of very episodic atmosphere to the book, and the way he wrote it is kind of cut and paste. It's very, I mean, I always say that if Melville had been writing now, he would never have finished the book because he'd always be Googling whales. And that's in fact what he did with Moby Dick. You know, between two hardcovers, he put every known fact about the whale and a lot of unknown facts and facts that he made up too.
So where did the idea come from to turn it into a 136-day-long installation?
Peninsula Arts hosted a joint exhibition I did with Angela Cocaine, who's my co-curator on this project, which was a hymn to the whale and to Moby Dick and to Melville himself. And out of that came this ambition to read the whole of the book. And initially, we wanted to do a 24-hour reading a chapter. But then we realised, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning, not going to have anyone hanging around listening to it. So we'll put it online. But it just grew exponentially in a very strange way. Partly because it's, you know, it's one of those books that so many people turn around and say, I've always wanted to read it. Or, you know, it's my favourite book. Or I hate it. It's a very challenging book in that way, you know. So a lot of people who, you know, like Tilda Swinton, for instance, had only ever read the first chapter. And I said, well, that's good, because that's the one we're going to ask you to read. Once you bring people into it, suddenly it opens up this kind of extraordinary world. And that's why the whole curation of the art side of the thing, you know, the pictures, the images from contemporary artists that we're using in the project, are part and parcel of it. There was such a competition for people to create an image to go with the chapter, which Will Self reads, The Whiteness of the Whale, which is this almost decadent list, catalogue of things which are white, but which actually symbolise evil, you know, like the polar bear or the shark. We even talk about abortions and ghosts and all sorts of bizarre things. It's a very trippy book. You know, it can be all things to all people, I think. And that's why you can have on one hand David Attenborough, on the other hand Will Self, or you can have, you know, Hugh Funley Whittingstall reading a recipe for how to eat a whale. You know, all these things come together in a way, and because of the eclecticism of Melville's writing and of this extraordinary crew of people he creates on this Pequod, this ship he sends out around the world, this ship of fools, it just makes for a great sort of aircraft carrier of a thing, you know, to bring all these people on board.
I'm wondering, you say that it's a book that you struggled with yourself when you first started reading it, and indeed that there are bits that piecewise that are difficult to kind of cope with, his the bits he's copied out from elsewhere and so on. What's the appeal of the book to you now?
To me, it's a fantastical historical record. No one has written better about Wales and probably never will. It looks at, obviously, at the time of whaling, of Yankee whaling, but it puts it in context, in a kind of natural history context. And, of course, a lot of what Melville writes is actually quite fantastical, but a lot of what he does write is rooted in what was then known about Wales. But, of course, it has this great political context as well. It was written during the lead-up to the American Civil War. The analogy with slavery is very clear in the book. I mean, it's not a coincidence that it's a great white whale. The idea of faith and religion, which Melville really addresses in quite a blasphemous way. In fact, he said to Nathaniel Hawthorne, who is his great inspirer in the book, he said, "I have written a blasphemous book, but I am spotless as a lamb." So he was aware of creating something which was very challenging. And I think that's what I find so surprising. This is one of the things that is completely counterintuitive about this book, which you know, it's taught in American high schools, and yet you've got whole chapters about a whale's foreskin, or, you know, mad sort of incredibly homoerotic passages. And yet this book is Barack Obama's favourite book.
It's interesting that you appreciate it more as a kind of social or historical document rather than as a kind of story. I remember reading it ages ago and there being these vast calms where there's these lists of shipbuilding materials, or indeed the bits he's copied out about whales, as you were describing just now. But then there are these moments of pure drama when they're on the tail of a particular whale, or indeed that cataclysmic confrontation at the end.
Well, it is that contrast, isn't it? It's almost as though you've got to have this lull where you've got, you know, the intricate details of how to flense a whale, how to peel the blubber off it, like an orange, you know, spiralling blubber, strips of blubber, and that whole process, which is then contrasted with these utterly, as you say, energised chapters, you know, about Ahab, who, I mean, there is no one more demonic than Ahab. And, of course, the reason, you know, why Ahab is the way he is because Melville, who'd, as a boy, had scarlet fever, and it had affected his eyesight, and he couldn't read small print very easily. And in the 1840s, a large print edition of Shakespeare's folio, first folio, the collected works came out, and suddenly he read Shakespeare, you know, age 30 or whatever. So suddenly he was, like, imbued with Shakespearean drama. So Ahab becomes this kind of mixture of King Lear and Hamlet and Othello and God knows what else, or Macbeth, you know, all piled into one. The book was never edited, for heaven's sake. And I think that's why now it still has this mad, sprawling impact. It's still trying to find its feet in the world, you know. It outlived Melville, but only, you know, by a scrape. I mean, Melville, when he died in 1891, was completely unknown. People like Henry James and Edith Wharton, who were sharing the same New York streets as Melville, had no idea that this guy, who'd actually been quite famous earlier, but not for Moby Dick, for his early travel writing, which was very sort of sexy travel writing, was still alive. So Moby Dick wasn't appreciated until the 1920s by modernists, by people like Auden and D.H. Lawrence and Virginia Woolf. That's what revived it. Moby Dick owes its reputation to Britain, actually.
In this era of environmental degradation, industrial fishing, there's a terrible poignancy in reading Melville's declaration that the whale is immortal in his species, however perishable in his individuality. How does Moby Dick, with its frankly commercial attitude to nature, speak to 21st century concerns over the planet and animal rights and so on?
Well, obviously, I mean, it's kind of equivocal, isn't it? Because they're out there hunting the whale. And isn't it interesting how throughout the book, Melville insists on calling the whale a fish? Now, of all the people who are aware that a whale is not a fish with the whalers, they were the guys who were cutting them open. They knew their physiology was exactly the same. It was mammalian. It was exactly the same as us. So there's a kind of dishonesty about that in a way, or a kind of evasion. And yet then you have this incredible chapter, which is read by Sir David Attenborough, "Does the whale perish? Will the whale perish?" And it's incredibly moving, because suddenly Melville is addressing the same situation that, I mean, I certainly lived through in my youth, the whole sort of Save the Whale campaign of the 1970s, which was pretty much the first environmental campaign, actually, and certainly the first successful one. He was addressing it, you know, 160 years ago. Everything is metaphorical and symbolic for him. So the whole notion of Ahab chasing this whale, which he invests with evil, is actually Melville, he's turning that round. He's saying the madness is in Ahab, it's in humanity. It's not in an animal. An animal can't be evil. It behaves according to instinct, unlike us, who have free will. And that's the most perfect reflection of the environmental problems that we face now.
You've got a host of contributors who've given you readings and artworks, images from artists such as Anish Kapoor, Mark Wallinger, Anthony Gormley. How are they going to fit together?
Again, in the wonderfully eclectic way that the book runs, you know, at one point you'll have extraordinary images of, you know, people suckling whales, human suckling whales, and then a very pure graphic illustration of a kind of fantastical whale. Angela Cocaine, particularly because she's such a practiced artist herself, has a very radical take on this. She wanted the images to be provocative. They're not illustrations. This isn't, you know, an illustrated book. These are images by absolutely key names and some really new and upcoming names in the art world, contemporary art world, who kind of take those greater themes that we've been talking about and address them in their own work. So I think, you know, ideas of exploitation, whether or not it's sexual exploitation, environmental exploitation, ideas of beauty and kind of purity versus despoilation, those are all there implicit in these images. I mean, one of the images I love is by George Shaw, who, of course, was shortlisted for the Turner Prize last year. Wonderful painter. He paints in humble paints. You know, it seems to me very key or very germane to Moby Dick, which has a kind of obsessive nature. You've got this obsessive painter who paints in some tiny paint pots, and he's painted it's a picture of a dilapidated garage on a housing estate, but it's white. And it has this kind of luminous quality, but sort of freighted with all sorts of complexities. Gavin Turk, who's engraved a sperm whale tooth with an image of melancholy, that's a beautiful piece. And Susan Hiller, who's a wonderful artist and created this extraordinary kind of seance of dangling lights in a chamber. There are some really magical images here, and films as well. There's a great film by an Israeli contemporary artist called Guy Ben-Nir, who actually reenacts Moby Dick in his kitchen with his three-year-old daughter.
Chapter 105. Does the whale's magnitude diminish? Will he perish?
For all these things, we account the whale immortal in his species, however perishable in his individuality. He swam the seas before the continents broke water. He once swam over the site of the Tuileries and Windsor Castle and the Kremlin. In Noah's flood, he despised Noah's Ark, and if ever the world is to begin again flooded like the Netherlands to kill off its rats, then the eternal whale will still survive, and rearing upon the topmost crest of the equatorial flood, spout his frothed defiance to the skies.
So, Philip Hoare breaking new ground there with the help even of Sir David Attenborough. A new reading is going to be published every day. You can find it at mobydickbigreads.com. Another new venture comes from our own reading group maestro, Sam Jordison, who also manages The Guardian's Not the Booker Prize. He's decided to cast aside his critic's cape, or should that be whip, and become a publisher himself. The first book of his new imprint, Galley Beggar Press, is a memoir of the poet and novelist Robert Graves, written by his great-nephew Simon Gough and entitled The White Goddess, An Encounter. So what better than to drag them both into the studio and ask why he made the move?
There's a bookshop in Norwich, The Book Hive, which is a lovely independent bookshop, and I would go in there and often lament the state of the books that were coming in to the owner, Henry Late. And, you know, we'd grumble about publishing and how we'd like things to be in an ideal world. And then one day Henry said he had a book and that we should put our money where our mouth is. And the book was The White Goddess and Encounter, which is our first book that's come out. You know, I took it away and read it and fell in love with it. And that's where it really came from, was falling for the book in parallel with having these grand ideas that we never thought would see the light of day. But
so
suddenly we were...
Are you going to publish other books, or is this the book?
We have a list developing, both of e-books and paper books. So we're kind of having two strands. And the next thing we're doing is actually My Elvis Blackout by Simon Crump, which is a work of genius. Of course, I'm biased, which came out a few years ago. And everyone should have bought it, but no one did. And it became very much a lost cause for me, and something I'd written about it a few times in The Guardian, in fact, because I loved it so much. And then I realised that once we were doing this, we could give books like My Elvis Blackout a second chance. So that's coming out as an e-book.
Okay, well, let's just move straight on to the main course, which is this amazing book, which is Simon Gough's The White Goddess and Encounter. And Simon is also here with us in the studio. Over to you. Tell us about it. It starts when you're 10 years old and you suddenly get whisked off to the island of Mallorca.
Yeah, I did, to join my mother, who was ill and in the middle of a divorce from my actor father. And she was an actress, and divorces in those days were very, in the theatre, very public, because everybody had to take sides. And so one's private life was sort of, in a way, destroyed, and one lost and gained friends in the strangest ways. And my mother, who was a rather nervous disposition, but she'd had TB, became ill, and Uncle Robert, my granduncle, sent her enough money to fly her to Mallorca and give her a holiday and give me a holiday.
Now, your Uncle Robert was none other than Robert Graves, who by that stage was Poet Laureate or was
about
to
become? No, he's never been Poet Laureate.
He was there? Oh, I thought he was Poet Laureate.
No, he turned it down.
You call this an auto-bi fantasy.
This is the third of four volumes. The point of it being, it's the life of a complete and utter nobody. A swatted fly on the wall of his own life, if you like.
That's you?
Me, half paralysed. All I can do is watch, observe, and listen. And it's from birth in volume one to my 21st birthday at the end of volume four, which is where this story ends, where The White Goddess ends. Not my granduncle's book, The White Goddess, but The White Goddess, An Encounter. This volume three leaves one on a cliff edge.
So have the other two volumes been published?
Nope, I'm still at them.
So isn't this rather wonderfully Widdershins in a very Gravesian way?
That you're, I like it.
You've gone backwards.
I really
back
like
to
it.
Your birth.
And then forwards.
And then forwards.
We might even go forwards and then backwards.
So Sam, were you not asking him, begging him to start from birth and do a sort of cradle to grave? Or does this not worry you in the slightest?
This was the story that immediately grabbed us. So it became apparent that it was part of a much bigger work. And so we're, you know, trying to encourage Simon to produce the rest for us now.
Tell us some of the wonderful things that happened. I mean, it starts with you... arriving as a 10-year-old boy and being led up, really up a garden path by your cousin.
He was completely and utterly wild. I loved him and sort of in a way feared him. He was like the worst nightmare a boy could have at prep school.
He's putting slugs up his nose.
Yes.
and forcing you to jump off cliff
absolutely.
Faces so
ending
you
up,
nearly die.
Absolutely, ending up...
setting off firecrackers to absolutely traumatise his father,
yes.
Who actually did have a problem because of his war experience.
Precisely. Goodbye to all that. He got terrible shell shock. And so explosions or noises or violent reactions of any kind or actions would set him off into a most desperate rage, because a firecracker in Mallorca in those days was a small stick of dynamite.
But yes. You're very active in the chaos, aren't you?
Well, that's where the catalysing seems to happen. You take part, as if you're watching yourself.
So you leave at 10, you have this idyllic time there, chaotic idyllic time, and then you come back 7 years later.
I'm a teenager, I'm on my way, I've been thrown out of my public school, and then went to university in Madrid. And on the way there, I was sent back to my great-uncle Robert to have a damn good talking to, and to be set right about how I should proceed in the rest of my life. And he took me straight in, having greeted me with the family outside on the drive, through the darkness of the kitchen, into the dazzling light in the dining room, there against the window, in a sort of epiphanic blaze of white, was Margot, his muse.
What was his relationship with Margot?
She was his muse.
There was no impropriety in his relationship with Margot.
I had absolutely no idea. I saw none, heard of none. she was the white goddess personified, and she inspired, to my mind certainly, and to other people's, some of his greatest lyric poetry.
She was quite manipulative, wasn't she? Because, I was reading it and I was thinking, I thought she manipulated your role in the relationship.
I'm sorry you think that. That wasn't at all what I meant to come across. I think everybody was in fact manipulated by a dream that Robert had in 1944. It was called The Roebuck in the Thicket. And that became his landmark book, The White Goddess. And in it, he predicted his own end, and at whose hands it would be. And the people concerned in this book are the same people who are in the 1944 book, The Roebuck in the Thicket.
But Margot wasn't there in 1944,
no,
was she?
No, but the muse was there. Do you see?
Was there another muse?
No, there was, of course. But the muse, the twin, the shoemaker and the poet. I was the shoemaker, the cordonnier, the petit cordonnier. Margot was the muse, and he, Robert, was the poet. That's all he said in 1944, but everything he said about them and what happened, the fate of the poet, came true. And it killed him in his head.
So we called it a novel.
called it a novel, you see.
Partly for legal reasons.
Oh, there are all quite a lot of surviving family members, aren't there?
Yeah, but also because I really feel it has the shape and form of a novel and can definitely be read as a novel, much like On the Road is an act of memory. But, you know, memory is, of course, unreliable and, you know, it's subjective. That's probably a better way of putting it. It's a highly subjective, deliberately subjective account.
There's one scene early on where you're sitting at a grand dinner with 18 people having this fantastic fish soup. You go in there thinking that you're all equal family, and during the course of the meal, you suddenly realise that actually you're all at Robert's court in order of his favouritism. What you describe is how your perception completely changes, therefore your reality altered during the course of that one meal.
Very true. And what was in a way tragic was that one couldn't go back to one's original perception of the innocence of everything, and suddenly one had bitten into the apple, as it were.
The big bite, of course, was your relationship with Margot, the muse.
Well, I fell passionately in love with her through no fault of her own. She did nothing to encourage it.
She tried to discourage you, in fact, didn't she?
Yes, in a way, but also we had such fun together, enormous fun. She had no other distraction in those days at that particular time but Robert and Beryl. And suddenly here was a kid, a 17-year-old kid, who could make her laugh, who could run with her, who could laugh and bounce down sheer cliffs and throw yourself into the sea and be wild. And she was wild. The wildness was so beautiful to watch. The wildness of thought, too, the no-nonsense, absolutely no-nonsense, no bollocks, just say it how it is. Don't say, can I ask a question? Ask the bloody question.
Why was she there? She wasn't from Daya, was she?
No, she wasn't.
Why was she there?
She'd been brought there by a friend of Robert's to meet Robert, certainly by fate, in if you put it in the connotation of what I've said about the Roebuck and the Thicket. He fell in love with her. And she became his muse, and it was unstoppable. He couldn't, there's nothing he or she, or as I say, anybody else could have done from that moment on. We all had our parts to play, and we played them to the death.
And poor old Beryl, I mean, it must have been pretty hard on her.
Well, this is the thing, you see, the one thing Beryl wasn't was poor or old. She was the feistiest, she had the sharpest, quickest brain. She watched out for Robert. She was in love with two things. She was in love with Robert, but she was also in love with his poetry. Do you see what I mean? So the muses, from Laura Riding, who was the first, and then a couple of others, and then Margot, and then some others, the poetry was paramount to her, as important in its way as Robert was.
Thank you very much. Now, what I want to do very quickly is to just move you on, Sam, to talk a little bit about Not the Booker, which I mentioned at the beginning, you are the maestro of. You're dealing on Not the Booker with a lot of small publishers, some of whom don't publish very well.
There was one who did things that I wouldn't have chosen to do, let's put it that way.
Which you have said.
Yeah.
Which is a hostage to fortune for you.
It was a difficult thing, actually. You know, I have considerably more sympathy for publishers and how easy it is to make mistakes, having done this book. But at the same time, there was one book that you know, really hadn't had the time.
And this is one of the books on the shortlist of this prize, which is The Guardian's Answer to the Booker Prize, and it's books nominated by readers, which actually is quite open to abuse, isn't it? I mean,
yeah.
Is it not a great big log-rolling exercise?
Yes and no. I think it is. And one of the fun things about the prize, in the way, is the log-rolling, because we keep it all deliberately open so everyone can see what happens. But I wouldn't want to go too far down the road of saying that it's all about log rolling, because a lot of the people that are voting are genuine fans of the books and, you know, have genuine passion for them. Otherwise, they wouldn't be taking the time and the trouble to vote. It's not just that they're friends of the authors, although in some cases they possibly is an influence as well.
They have to write a review of the book. They don't just put a vote down. So there is a bit of investment on behalf of the voters, isn't there?
That's right.
Just run us through very quickly the shortlist.
We have The Notable Brain of Maximilian Ponder by J.W. Ironmonger, which was a complete surprise to me. It's a book I'd never have read and probably never have picked up, but was absolutely wonderful. It's brilliant. It was funny. It was touching. It was difficult, not in the sense of reading it was difficult, but, you know, it took you to quite difficult and interesting places. It's kind of made you think about death in quite profound ways. And I thought it was absolutely brilliant.
So moving on to the next one.
Yeah, so this was Paint the Town Red by A.J. Kirby, which is the one I've already talked about. It was not impressive. It was a horror novel, but the horror came more from the prose than the beasties that were supposed to be haunting this small island, unfortunately. A.J. Kirby clearly has some talent. There were really good moments. He did a good job of getting that hothouse atmosphere and incest and, you know, mental problems that come with living on a small island. So had he spent more time on it and had it been better edited, it could have been quite interesting. But as it was a terrible pain to read.
And next one?
Life Death Prizes by Stephen May. And this, again, was a complete surprise to me, although it's published by Bloomsbury and is shortly being made into a film. And the fact that it's been made into a film doesn't surprise me at all. Really reminded me of Nick Hornby, which is a compliment, by the way, for our more cynical listeners. It was really smoothly written, quite funny. Again, like Nick Hornby, he treads a really fine line between emotion and mawkishness, but comes out on just the right side. You know, he's deliberately pushing emotional buttons and deliberately kind of sentimental, but it works. And he manages to carry it off, which is a considerable skill. So another good one.
That's three. So we've got another four. You've got seven. That's a very odd number. It's like the book of 13,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, in the usual chaos of the voting, an extra book sneaked on. Actually, I can explain, because the reason was Tales from the Moor by Ewan Morrison was taken on and off the list because we couldn't decide whether it was a novel or not.
That's one I've read, actually, and I think it is every bit as much a novel as The White Goddess is a novel, actually.
As the title says, it's all about shopping malls, and it has a mix of fact and fiction. It tells the story of malls as they kind of grew up after the war in America onto the present day when they're starting to decline. As that story's gradually told, little short stories are interspersed, and even though I didn't always like the short stories, overall I thought the effect of the book was really powerful. It gives a really strong sense of not just how malls operate, but how, if this doesn't sound too ridiculously grandiose, how the whole of Western society is put together at the moment. And he funnels that through the building of the mall really impressively. And again, it was worth reading.
The next one is Ben Myers' Pig Iron.
Yeah, Pig Iron is wonderful. I've actually read this, and I should admit to a certain amount of bias here in that, because I know Ben Myers and like him, but
this is cabalism, isn't it? This is what we're accused of in literary journalism all the time. You, a publisher with a friend whose book is on your prize.
Isn't it sickening? My defence, but I came to know Ben Myers because I liked his writing. So it was his writing that led me
to
him.
That's what they all say.
I have documentary evidence from The Guardian, in fact. The first article I wrote that mentioned Ben is up there. It's a fantastic book.
Then we're on to The Revelations by Alex Preston.
And again, I'm biased because I've met and liked Alex, but this is a really interesting book. And I've actually written a book about cults myself. And the theme of Alex Preston's book briefly is evangelical Christian organisation that becomes, you know, it has cultish elements. And the thing he's done, which I never managed to do in my book, is to really, while not being on the side of the cult organisation at all, to really try to understand and empathise with the characters within it.
Last but not least, Simon Swift's The Casablanca Case.
This is the one I haven't read yet, so I can't say much about this, but it is published by the same publisher as A.J. Kirby, but hopefully it will turn out to be much better. We'll see.
When is the prize going to be announced?
2 days before the official book in October.
Sam Jordison and Simon Gough there. The White Goddess, An Encounter is published by Galley Beggar Press. Now, a couple of weeks ago, we asked for your views about this podcast, and since then, we've been chatting away with all the various people who responded. We're hoping to lure some of them onto the podcast in the next few weeks to share their reading tips. A few new comments have come in over the week, and Sarah Crown now joins me to discuss them. Sarah.
Yes, the two that we've picked out because we felt that they were particularly astute are from a user called Literary Reference, who says, "It's nice to hear about books from different cultures and writers with different backgrounds. Could we please have more?" And a user called Grutz for Tea, which is an amazing name, who said that he or she found it well-produced and enjoyable, which is very nice to hear, but felt, among other things, that we did too much fiction.
So, Sarah, too much fiction. Defend us.
I'm not sure that I can, actually. I think we probably do too much. Well, I don't know if one can ever have too much fiction, but certainly the balance is probably skewed in favour of fiction. And I think that there are a lot of reasons for that, but I think that possibly one that might hopefully be of interest to people is to do with the new setup of journalism, the internet, basically. When we're talking about books online, the subject barrier of books becomes a lot more porous than it would be in the paper. So in the paper, in the review section, you review all the books, non-fiction, almost sort of more dominantly, I think, than fiction. But when you're talking about it in an online environment, if you have a big book about politics or a big book about science, then the chances are that what happens is you go with the content rather than the form. So the big book about politics will be covered on the politics bit of the website because of what it's actually talking about, because what's being said in it. And the big book about science will be covered by the science section of the website because they're more fitted than we are really to talk about science, which I think is fairly inarguable. So then what happens is that you, as a books editor online, end up just almost by default concentrating more on fiction. And obviously this wouldn't be true on a book site like, for example, The Complete Review, which is purely about books and isn't affiliated with a newspaper. But in the newspaper environment, that's kind of what happens. So I guess then that could really be quite annoying for users, because you come to a books podcast expecting to hear about all the books, and we end up, just because of sort of the internal machinery of The Guardian, concentrating on fiction. So yeah, all I can offer is my explanation and my apologies.
However, we have done some really good non-fiction stuff. It's something that we can often mop up at festivals, and not least at the Edinburgh International Book Festival, which has just happened. And there were a couple of programmes I would draw to the attention of anyone who is sunning themselves on a beach at the time, and it includes Jonathan Steele and Sadiqat Qadri on the myths of Sharia law and the war in Afghanistan, and Frank Vesterman, this is my favourite, on eugenics and the Lipizzaner horse. So if you want to find out what the Lipizzaner horse has to do with eugenics, this is the place to look. And not to mention also the godfather of stuntmen, Vic Armstrong, on whether Tom Cruise, among others, really does do his own stunts. We'll be doing more in coming weeks, including maps and Victorian madhouses. There's a lineup for you.
And then, yeah, to respond to Literary References criticism, we do try fairly hard to keep up our tally of writers from different cultures. It's definitely something that we're aware of. It's not audio, but we did have a really fascinating written piece on the website from the German writer Jörg Klein, I think that's how you say his name, this week, about the future of fiction. And it was Berlin's contribution to the Edinburgh World Writers Conference. And you can find it if you go and have a look for it on our Edinburgh Festival page. It's really worth reading.
You can catch up with all our podcasts by going to the front page of the Guardian Books website and clicking on the podcast tab at the top of the page. Do please continue to let us know what you think by joining the comment thread beneath the podcast. If we've mentioned your name, drop me an email on claire.armitstead@guardian.co.uk and I'll send you a book from the cupboard. We've already sent a batch off to last week's correspondents. One of them, Pied Warbler, was keen on hearing what we're all reading, and Sarah wasn't here at the time. So Sarah, tell us.
Okay, well, actually, last week I had a very pleasant memory lane reading experience of picking up a copy of Three Men in a Boat on a market stall in Cambridge, where I was for the day. And it was great. I haven't read it for a few years now, but I had a couple of lines from it that had really sort of resurfaced in my mind, and I thought I really wanted to reread it. So when I saw a copy, I picked it up, and it was fantastic. But at the minute, I'm actually doing the thing that probably is what happens most of the time, which is reading for work, which is one of the great privileges of this job, although it does mean that your reading is sort of a bit more structured and less meandering than it might otherwise be. And the book that I'm reading at the minute is, in fact, for a podcast that we'll be doing in a couple of weeks' time with D.T. Max, who is the biographer of David Foster Wallace. And in order to speak to him from a position of knowledge rather than ignorance, I decided that I had to read David Foster Wallace's best-known book, Infinite Jest, which I've never read before. And this is kind of great, actually, because normally what happens is you end up following the publishing schedule. You're only reading the new stuff that comes out. And I missed Infinite Jest completely. You know, it's been out for ages, obviously, but I never read it when it came out. And so I kind of thought in the back of my head that it was one of those books that I would never actually read. And so when the opportunity came up to interview DT Maxx, I thought, right, this is it. This is my one chance. I can actually call it work and get on and read it. So that's what I'm doing. And it's great.
And you have a theory about it that it's actually science fiction, which really surprised me.
It is science fiction. I started reading it and I had that realization of when you come to a book that has been much spoken about, that everyone's read and that is canonized, really, I suppose, these days, that I had no idea what it was about at all. I mean, I didn't know the storyline. I didn't know the plot. I had absolutely no idea. And I started reading it. And it is, it's science fiction. But it's one of those things that, you know, I guess no one would call it science fiction because it's such a sort of divisive label. But it is. It's near future, but it's set in a time where the years are given, rather than numbers, they're all sort of sponsored by advertisers. So it's the year of the trial size Dove bar and that kind of thing. And there's different technology, there are interesting drugs. And what it really reminded me more than anything else of was Alistair Gray's book, Lanik. It has that same atmosphere of sort of heavy technologicalness that I remember so much from that.
You make it sound like Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, actually, as somebody who also hasn't read it.
Yeah, no, not quite that.
Not quite that.
No, but it is funny, though, as well.
Now, I'm reading something completely different, which is The 100-Year-Old Man Who Climbed Out of the Window, which was recommended by one of our most interesting reader reviewers, Aggie H. It's by a Swedish writer, Jonas Jonasson, I think it's pronounced. And if you're listening, Aggie, so far I'm hugely enjoying the company of 100-year-old Alan, though I'm a bit concerned about his feet in those carpet slippers. And that's all from us this week. So thanks to Philip Hoare and his readers of Moby Dick, to Sam Jordison and Simon Gough, to Sarah and our producer Tim Mabey. I'm Claire Armistead. Goodbye.
Hi, I'm Simon Hattonstone. I'm a Guardian journalist and I occasionally write books that are not read by many people. Let me tell you about some of the great advice from those who really know how to do it. Top name authors that you can read in a new Guardian book called Write. It's brilliant. Funny, perverse, bonkers and wise. If it sounds like writing, then I rewrite, says Elmore Leonard. There's Anne Enright for despairing writers. Remember, the first 12 years are the worst. So, don't put off that dream of winning the Booker Prize any longer. Get inspired by our new Guardian book, Write. You can get yours for half price, £6.50, using promo code PODCAST. To order, visit guardian.co.uk/bookshop. Anytime up to the end of October.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.